All right. Good morning, everyone. This is Judge Flory. If you can hear me, would you raise your or wave your hand, please?
It's very broken, Judge
All
Flory, right
right.
now.
So I don't know if that anybody can hear me at this point.
Oh, now it's good.
Can you hear me now? All right, how about now? Is this better? I'm seeing some buffering on the screen. Yeah, I can hear that clearly. How about you? Can you hear me? All right, I'm sick. Yeah, I don't know. It must take just a minute to make the connection. I'm actually a couple hundred miles north of everyone else, so maybe it takes longer for the signal to get up here. So anyway, we'll call the next case. It's State of Minnesota versus Derek Lee Enderle, court file A19 1865. Our technology has been working okay this morning now that we're connected. If someone can't hear me at some point, or anybody, raise your hand and we'll try to correct the problem. If you're not speaking, it's helpful if you'll have your microphone on mute, because then we don't hear rustling of papers and other things like that. There's also a call-in number if you happen to get disconnected in the invitation. So, as you begin your arguments, identify yourselves for the record. You each have 15 minutes for your principal arguments, and then appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. So, with that, we'll begin. Counsel for appellant, please identify yourself and you may begin.
May it please the court, good morning. My name is Daniel Repka. I represent the appellant in this matter, Derek Lee Enderle. The appellant respectfully requests a decision from this court to reverse Mr. Enderle's sentences and remand it for resentencing back to the district court. I follow the both published and unpublished decisions in this court every week, and it seems as though every week there's at least one unpublished decision talking about the issue today, which is Minnesota Statute 609.035, which prohibits multiple punishments for offenses that constitute one behavioral act or one behavioral incident. And that's exactly what this case deals with. Based on the research that I have completed, what I've learned is that district courts are precluded from imposing multiple punishments on defendants, even if there are separate charges that constitute the same behavioral act. In this case, as the court knows, Mr. Enderle pled guilty on a Norgaard basis to criminal sexual conduct in the third degree and criminal sexual conduct in the fourth degree. We understand that those pleas were entered based on two different actions of Mr. Enderle. The fourth degree criminal sexual conduct plea was based on sexual contact earlier in the evening in question, whereas criminal sexual conduct in the third degree, or his plea for that charge, was based on sexual penetration later in the subject evening. But here, what is important to understand is whether the district court erroneously imposed multiple sentences in violation of 609.035. It is the state's burden of proof to prove by a preponderance of the evidence that multiple actions do not constitute one behavioral act. And my research reveals that on appeal, so long as the facts are not disputed, the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court will review the district court's decision de novo.
So, Mr. Repka, the trial court found that these two acts were not part of a continuous and uninterrupted course of conduct. And it seems like the undisputed facts in the record are that there were significant intervening circumstances between the two incidents. So why was the district court wrong about that determination?
Because what the court has to focus on, both at the district court level and also at the Court of Appeals level, is not just the timing, not just a unity in time, but also what was motivating the defendant? Was there a single criminal objective? And here, there was absolutely one single criminal objective. And that
so how do we understand that argument in light of the Supreme Court's decision in I think it's Barthman, where it says sexual gratification isn't part of a single criminal objective? It seems to me sexual gratification, sexual intercourse, as you're arguing here, seem to be one and the same, considering the separation between the two acts.
That's true, but the Supreme Court also held in, bear with me while I review my notes. The Supreme Court also held in State v. Hedberg that the motivation to perform fellatio and anal penetration did constitute one single criminal act. The defendant in that case kidnapped, I believe, a 14-year-old at knife point and dragged her across state lines by motor vehicle and ultimately performed both vaginal and anal penetration in two separate incidents. And the Supreme Court there held that the single criminal objective of the defendant was his perverted desire to achieve sexual penetration. So, Judge, to answer your question, I believe those holdings are in contest with each other, because what Hedberg holds is that a defendant's desire to for sexual gratification, as Your Honor said, can be held as a basis for a single criminal behavioral act, or the motivation to obtain a single criminal objective. And here, if I may, the record absolutely supports that intent on Mr. Enderle, the appellant.
Can I ask a question, counsel? Let's assume instead of this is a sexual assault, instead the appellant struck the victim first time, hours intervened, you know, went back outside, had an argument, ate, watched TV, got sick, fell asleep, and went down and struck her again. Are those separate behavioral incidents? They're both motivated by just dislike for the victim.
It's hard for me to say, Your Honor, and I mean that as respectfully as possible, because this is such a fact-intensive inquiry.
Right. The only difference is the nature of the assault that I'm talking about. I mean, it seems to me, I mean, if you have an assault where there are multiple punches thrown, each one of them in the same behavioral incident isn't going to constitute another, is going to be within the same behavioral incident. And that's sort of what the law gets to. But when they're separated to physical assaults by hours, and it's not a continuous course of conduct, it seems pretty easy. It seems to make it a lot harder just to say, well, there's a sexual gratification here. It seems to make it more like that gives makes them more unified simply for sexual assault crimes as opposed to other types of crimes where they'd be quite clearly, I think, separated by other types of conduct intervening.
I think you bring up a very important part of this analysis. Of course, the attorney in me, who is representing my client, wants to say, well, of course it's still one criminal objective. But if we're looking at this independently, one of the factors is unity in time. And the timing is important, because the longer of time that passes between the first incident and the second incident, at least in my view of the case law, would reveal that the unity in time gets weaker and weaker and weaker with each passing moment. But the unity in time is not the only thing to consider in this analysis. Judge, in your hypothetical with striking, it's really difficult for me to say, and I'm not trying to be obstructionist, I'm not trying to be obtuse, because it depends on what that defendant's criminal objective is. If it's literally the same as Mr. Enderle's, then I think the offense does make it a little different, because the criminal intent of sexual gratification, at least the way I see it, as subjectively as I do, admittedly, is different than the desire to strike somebody in the face. I don't have any research or case law to back up my specific position as it relates to the answer to your question, but I think the criminal intent of achieving sexual gratification is different than the gratification of, as Your Honor said, punching somebody in the face. Because as I understand it, the only way to achieve the intent of sexual gratification is to have sex. Whereas if you strike somebody in the face, I don't know what the gratification is there, but I would imagine that the gratification is achieved upon striking that person in the face. And if you walk away, at that point, it becomes potentially a separate offense.
Well, yeah. Isn't that just sort of an argument about semantics? I mean, if the hypothetical was, the intent was to beat the person so badly that you would kill them. So first time you hit them, it's interrupted, you go down 4 hours later and beat them so badly that they die. So isn't it just a matter of semantics then, that the intent was, I don't like this person, so I want to injure them, in which case it might be two separate incidents. I mean, how do we get around that, particularly with Norgaard? And then how do you deal with the State versus Stevenson case, where we know that was similar to Barthman in the sense that it was a kidnapped victim, and it was all part of in the course of a single kidnapping, but they said 5 hours turns it into two incidents. And here we know that there was a passage of time. So how do we deal with that? How do we distinguish this case? If you were in charge of writing this opinion, what would be the factors you'd rely on most heavily?
I would rely on, first, the criminal objective of the appellant here is sexual gratification. Ultimately, that is the first part of the analysis, is what is the defendant's, or in this case, the appellant's criminal objective, and that is to have sexual intercourse with the victim in this case. The other things that the court has to consider, or if I'm the court, the other things I have to consider is whether the appellant's conduct occurred at substantially the same time and place and arose in a continuous and uninterrupted course of conduct manifested by an indivisible state of mind. And all of those factors are present here. I rely most heavily on the indivisible state of mind and the single criminal objective. I fully understand that the passage of time weakens the unity of time, but we still have the unity of place, and that place is appellant's residence. All of this happened, as Your Honor said, in one evening over the course of, I believe the record would support, approximately 5 hours. But actually, we have to take a step back from that, because this all starts in the earlier part of the evening, when the Mr. Enderley, the appellant, and his family and the victim all get together for a bonfire. We can't say for sure. The record doesn't reveal for sure when exactly the seed of Mr. Enderley's criminal intent was planted, but it has to be at some point when either Mr. Enderley began consuming alcohol, or when the victim in this case flashed her breasts at the appellant. And I want to be very clear. I am not in any way arguing on behalf of the appellant that the victim invited this conduct. But it's important to distinguish when the seed was planted in Mr. Enderley's mind as to when he formulated that criminal intent, that criminal objective. That's what I rely on most heavily. Then I rely on whether his actions were motivated or manifested by an indivisible state of mind. And that absolutely is the case here, because the indivisible state of mind is he wants to achieve sexual penetration or sexual gratification with the victim. And now that I'm actually discussing this with Your Honor, it brings me back to Judge Flory's question about whether sexual gratification is enough to overturn a sentencing like Mr. Enderley's. And here, it's not only the sexual gratification that's at play, because sexual gratification can be achieved in several different manners. It can be very subjective. Here, the single criminal objective is not necessarily the gratification, but the sexual penetration, which then, of course, would lead to the sexual gratification. The other component.
I don't know if you can see the clock or not, Mr. Repke. I'll just tell you, you have 2 minutes remaining.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, to finish answering your question, I also rely on the unity of place, because here this all happened at Mr. Enderley's residence, all in the same evening. The factors that I would like the court to consider when determining whether this was one behavioral act are all of the circumstances surrounding Mr. Enderley's actions, that being that this was a bonfire, this was a get-together at his residence, alcohol was consumed by both the victim and the appellant. Again, not in any way pushing the onus on the victim here for what happened. I want to make that very clear. Also, all of this happened within not only Mr. Enderley, the appellant's residence, but it happened inside the residence. We have the objective on behalf of appellant being manifested at the time when presumably the victim flashed her breasts at him. And then it perpetuates or it continues as soon as that first sexual contact is made. Ultimately, while the record supports that several hours passed between the not only when Mr. Enderley's criminal objective was planted, that seed was planted in his mind, but also when the first sexual contact was made and then the sexual penetration was made. That is ultimately the weakest part of the analysis, but it doesn't defeat Mr. Enderley's argument that there was no unity of time. I see that I have about 15 seconds left. So with that, I will reserve the rest of my argument for rebuttal. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Repke. Mr. Kennedy, you'll have 15 minutes also. Were you able to see the clock on the screen?
I was, Your Honor.
Okay. So I won't prompt you as to the time. I'll assume you can see it. If you, for any reason, can't, you can simply ask where you're at in terms of your time, and I'll let you know. You may proceed with your argument.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is George Kennedy. I appear on behalf of respondent, the state of Minnesota. In this case, the appellant has not challenged the fact determination that these two sexual assaults were separated by a significant break in time of at least hours. Whether these were one behavioral incident or separate behavioral incidents is a legal question that looks at the unity of time and place, and whether there was a single criminal objective unifying this conduct. The state agrees that these occurred at the same place, but that isn't the decisive issue. We look at all the facts and circumstances in the case, as the district court did, and it's a flexible analysis. Looking at those factors, specifically the lack of unity in time and the lack of a unifying criminal objective, these were separate behavioral incidents, and this court should affirm the district court's sentence. Turning to the unity of time, we know that there was a significant break, and that's corroborated by the record. There is case law on point talking about the lower bounds of what does or does not constitute a single behavioral incident. Spears, Stevenson, and Barthman give some guidance on what makes multiple incidents one behavioral incident. In Spears, we know that 45 minutes or three incidents of sexual assault occurring over a 45-minute period is a single behavioral incident. We know from Stevenson that 5 hours separating two separate sexual assaults makes them separate behavioral incidents. This case falls somewhere between those two. We know from the record that there was, after the incident of sexual contact, there was approximately 40 minutes of arguing with the appellant's wife. Then he drank by the fire by himself, made himself some food, watched some TV, threw up for a while, and then passed out. We know that a considerable period of time passed because he could remember the first incident, but he could not recall the facts of the sexual penetration. That shows that these were not at the same point in time. In Barthman, we look at that case, it talks about how if one case can be discussed, or if one incident can be discussed and then a separate incident can be discussed without commingling those facts, they are separate in time. We have that here. So unity of time weighs in favor of two sentences. Turning to the criminal objective, there is extensive case law, most recently State v. Barthman, talking about how it's a single criminal objective, not the same criminal objective, and how broad statements of general purpose do not unify its incidents. In Barthman, there were multiple sexual offenses. There was an argument that those were unified because the appellant was seeking sexual gratification, and that argument was rejected outright. It's the same situation here. We have an incident of sexual contact, so there was an intent to have contact for sexual gratification, and then some hours later, the appellant separate criminal intent to engage in sexual penetration or gratification. Those are two separate objectives, and they cannot be unified. Appellant has pointed to Herberg as evidence that a sexual intent can unify multiple instances of sexual assault, but that case is pretty specific. In Herberg, the appellant was a compulsive sexual offender. He engaged in a litany of degrading acts, and the state Supreme Court decided that these were all unified because he had, based on who he was, a need to satisfy his perverse sexual needs. That is not the case here. In this case, we're looking at an incident of sexual contact that was interrupted. And then later on, instead of after the interruption was over, but hours later, going back and re-engaging, starting anew and engaging in sexual penetration.
Mr. Kennedy, if I could interrupt just for a quick minute. So how are we to, from this record, determine the criminal objective for these two different incidents? And you just mentioned that the first one was interrupted. So what do we do with that? Mr. Repka argues that the intent there was to go ahead and have intercourse, but his wife interrupted that. What in the record do we look at to pinpoint the criminal objective?
I think we can look at the appellant's plea when he was explaining why he had sexual contact. He wasn't saying, I did this because I wanted to have sex or I wanted to have sexual penetration. It was, I put my hand under her clothing and I did it for sexual reasons. So looking through all of this, looking at the record, the plea that he entered, and then the Norgaard basis for the incident of sexual penetration, we can see that there are separate intents in both of these instances. He isn't saying when he entered his plea, I had sexual contact because I wanted to have sexual penetration. It was, I committed this act with sexual intent, and then later on, there was a separate incident. Barthman also talks about how it's only a single criminal objective if one offense is in the furtherance of or incidental to the successful completion of any other offense. That isn't the case here. And we know that because each of these can be explained or discussed without a necessary reference to the other.
Just to be clear on your argument, if both had occurred, seconds apart, the first sexual contact and then penetration, is it your argument that they'd still be arising out of a separate behavioral incident because they have different criminal objectives? Well, that's my question. What do we look at for that objective? Or does it have to be, what does one have to conclude that the initial sexual contact was incidental to, meaning it was directed at achieving the later or seconds later penetration? I'm just, it seems to me the big thing in this case is the interruption in different activities between them, more so than what was in the mind at the moment that the sex assaults occurred.
I agree that the passage of time is significant in this case, and that's one of the reasons why I think State v. Stevenson carries a lot of weight on this case. If these two incidents were seconds apart, if there wasn't an interruption and it carried from sexual contact directly through to sexual penetration, I don't think we would be here today. We'd be in a situation where that is, in my analysis, one course of conduct, and there would be only be a single sentence, because it's a single action. You wouldn't be able to break it up into two distinct episodes. I also think that it's telling that the appellant here could remember one of these incidents and had to rely on Norgaard to enter his plea to the second incident. If enough time had passed that he could not recall the facts, I think that really shows these are two separate incidents and there was no error in imposing two sentences. I also would like to point out that I disagree with the appellant's statements that the unifying criminal objective is a subjective analysis. I think that the case law talking about how it can't be a general, I believe Barthman talked about how it cannot be a general or broad statement of criminal purpose. I think that that implies there is some objectivity required to say whether or not it's one criminal intent or multiple purposes that divide these cases. So here, because we have the specific intent to engage in sexual contact, and then later on the specific intent to engage in sexual penetration, we do not have a unified sexual or a unified criminal objective. These were not part of a continuous course of conduct. There was an extensive interruption between these two incidents. For all those reasons, if there are no additional questions, we respectfully request that you affirm the district court sentence.
Any other questions from the panel? Right, seeing none, thank you, Mr. Kennedy. Mr. Repka, you would have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you wish.
Thank you, Your Honor. I direct this part of my rebuttal to the Honorable Chief Judge. In her question during my initial argument, there was a reference to, are we playing semantics here? And the answer is resoundingly yes. This is and I don't mean to sound as I'm downplaying the court's role or the role in the district court. But what this boils down to, and I think counsel for respondent summed it up very well, that this is a flexible analysis. What has to be done is a review of all of the facts in the record to determine if the district court erroneously imposed multiple sentences for one behavioral act. And in this case, as the court probably has seen, the Barthman decision came out about a week or two after my brief was due. So I didn't have the benefit of briefing that issue in my initial brief. The reason I didn't brief it in a responsive brief is because I didn't have the authorization from my client to do so. But what's important to see in the Barthman analysis is that the Supreme Court held that in the Barthman case, there was no unity in time and there was no criminal objective in the two offenses. Here, there is a unity in time. The unity in time is, albeit weaker than in other cases that have been argued before the Court of Appeals, the 45-minute case, for example. The unity in time there was much stronger. But that doesn't mean there is no unity in time in this case. Additionally, there is the same criminal objective, unlike that of the Barthman case. The criminal objective of the appellant was sexual intercourse. In respondent's oral argument, the counsel indicated or argued that this is all of Mr. Enderle's actions were guided by the specific intent to achieve a result. I don't necessarily disagree with that conclusion as I think about it on my feet. It would be foolish to argue that Mr. Enderle's actions were guided by general intent. But the specific intent in Mr. Enderle's actions were not singularly motivated in the moment by accomplishing, number one, the sexual contact, and then number two, achieving the specific intent of sexual intercourse. This was all unified by Mr. Enderle's desire for sexual intercourse. And as the court, I think, sees, there were events that broke up the time and broke up Mr. Enderle's actions that potentially were beyond his control, such as Mr. Enderle's wife interrupting and there being an argument, and Mr. Enderle indisposing himself in the bathroom. Unless the court has any further questions for me, that's all I have. I ask that the court reverse the sentence of the district court and order the resentencing of the appellant based on the arguments. Thank you.
All right, I see no other questions of the panel here, so I thank counsel for your arguments and your briefing on the issue. We will take the matter under advisement at this time, and we will issue a decision within the 90-day period. If there's nothing further, then we stand adjourned on this matter. Thank you.